Hi everyone, good night and good evening. My name is Julio and I am an alcoholic. Buenas noches, mi nombre es Julio y soy un alcohólico. And as Sweetie said, I am a drunk from the Bronx. I'm really happy to be here, and before I forget, the first thing I want to do is thank Tandy and all of the PRASA host committee for this opportunity to be here. I truly am moved by the many friends that I've found and been able to reconnect with, as well as all the new friends that I made this weekend. It's really what makes AA so special and wonderful for me. This ability to reconnect, as well as always to create new friendships, because we have this bond that connects us, this suffering that we share. So it's easy to make that connection. So I'm really very, very happy to be here. So I'm going to just share a little bit of what it was like. And when I say I'm an alcoholic, I'm really saying that I am a fall down, blackout, bedwetting drunk. And that really defines myself, defines me, and that's what I became. It's not how I started, but it's certainly what would happen to me if I ever took a drink. So I know that for me, I need to be here. So I don't want to be that person that I got to be. But I certainly know and need to remember that I fell down in very nice places. and I'm not going to go into the rest of that. But just happy to be here and grateful. So my journey began in the Dominican Republic. I'm originally from the island, and my drinking began fairly early when I was probably around 12 or 13. I drank because my peers, my brother, my cousins, were all drinking because we thought that that's what, you know, grown men do, and we wanted to grow up fast. But in my case, I didn't come from an alcoholic family. My parents weren't alcoholic. There were, you know, glimmers of alcohol in the family. I had an aunt who loved to drink. She was my favorite aunt, of course. But at home, I didn't experience that. They weren't drinkers. But as I said, it was something that all of the kids, you know, around my age were doing, but I couldn't get it. I mean, I really didn't know what the big deal was. I would drink, I would get sick, couldn't get it. And at the same time as this was, you know, starting this process, I was also realizing in retrospect that I was very withdrawn, very introverted. I was basically, I felt I didn't fit in anywhere. And maybe I had that kind of, there were some reasons. I mean, I realized that also at that fairly early age that I, you know, my sexual orientation was different. And it was a different time, it was a different place. And it just added to the layers of secret that I started to accumulate. And it was just part of my life. And, you know, the not fitting in, the not feeling part of anywhere, it just compounded. So, you know, even if alcohol didn't seem to do the trick, I kept trying. And the one moment in that process that I remember clearly is that moment when I was at a party. And I was probably about 15 at that point. And there was this fancy party. There was a girl was celebrating her 15th birthday, like quinceañera, as some of you know. It was very fancy. The house was illuminated. There was an orchestra. There was a pool with flowers floating in it. Everybody was nicely dressed. You know, so was I, of course. And they were serving my favorite drink. Free booze. Never change. And, you know, and it hit me. The magic totally hit me. And, you know, I felt that weight on my shoulders lifted, that I finally fit in, that I could be funny, that I could talk to people, and I felt that, you know, that sense when you feel that you're part of, and, you know, I imagined that that's how other people felt, and that finally I'm getting this sense of belonging. So I made jokes, I danced, I sang, I went up to the young lady that was celebrating her birthday, we danced, I danced with her mother. I mean, it was wonderful. They were still trying to figure out who I was because I hadn't been invited. But, you know, I was everywhere, and I floated out of that party on a cloud. And knowing somewhere in my inner self that I found my solution. Because, you know, my outlook on life up to that point had been really very, very dark. I didn't really have a nice outlook. And now I found something that worked. So this was my solution. And I started to drink as much as I could and as often as I could. Because I knew that that worked. Every time there was an opportunity, I would go for it. And it really changed my life because, you know, I could look forward to something. She knows me already. So I basically, you know, made my life around alcohol. And, you know, and I was young. I was still in my teens. I was living at home. So I had to work out these logistics of this. But I really made it my purpose to go out and drink as often as I could. And I looked forward to it. And it made my life possible because as hard as I thought everything was, I could look forward to this. And it really provided the relief and the sense of belonging and this false sense that there was nothing wrong in the world. The policemen were short. I was tall. Everything was perfect. So, you know, I just kept on drinking, except that my drinking started to change. And it didn't take very long, but, you know, fairly soon, my drinking had really turned and took a turn. The first sign on this turn on the road was the blackouts. Ooh, the blackouts. And for me, my first blackout was actually scary. Because I couldn't understand why, how I lost this time, this period of time. I mean, like, it was just scary. But it didn't stop me. I mean, it really just really made me pay attention. The other thing that I realized that was different, it was the way that I started, that I drank. Not that I had a complaint about anything. It was just that it was strange that once I started to drink, I just didn't stop. I just sort of like lost track of time. No matter how much I promised my parents that I was going to be home before a certain time. And for me, you know, like I just wanted to be home before my parents got up the next day. And I couldn't even make that. Because once I started to drink, all I wanted was more. And I just kept on going till something, you know, outside of my own will changed that. Of course, it was usually that I passed out, that I ran out of booze, or something outside of myself. But for myself, all I wanted was to drink more. And I used to go out with a friend of mine that was my kind of partner in crime, and we would, you know, really go out, save our coins and get out, and we had a purpose. We wanted to get drunk and have a lot of fun. Of course, she would always, the next day would tell me, she would talk to me about this little voice that she had that said, oh, I had enough, I'm a little dizzy. I said, what voice? I've never heard it. And you know, that's how my drinking evolved. And of course, I was, you know, as I say, living at home, and that created conflicts. I realized that, you know, I wasn't happy with the way things were going, but, you know, no matter what my parents said or promises I made, the one thing that I could not promise was that I was not going to drink. There was this theory or this idea or this suggestion that I have two drinks when I go out. You too, right? I mean, I genuinely tried to really not get in trouble. So I would try to go out and have those two drinks, and it never worked. Once I have one drink, I was off to the races. And then it started this periods of just going out, getting drunk, always getting so angry at myself for not being able to control it. And the next day was just the guilt, the remorse, the shame. I had to check the bed to see if it was dry or wet. Where was the car? Go walk around the car. And you know, and my remorse and guilt was genuine. I really didn't want that to be my life, but I just could not give up on this one thing that made me feel a little different. And it was non-negotiable. And for years, you know, I started at that point my long road of trying to get it right, because I continually was trying everything that I could think of to make it work, because I could not imagine letting go of this solution, this magic that I found in alcohol. So, you know, I tried everything that they told me. I mean, like a spoonful of olive oil, some greasy dinner before I went out drinking, glass of milk, put rum in the milk in the rum. Nothing worked. The results were exactly the same. I tried once switching to beer because I didn't like beer. You know, it was too, like, waste of time. But I soon found out that, you know, I could like beer after two. And then I was again off to the races. So I was in this situation for a few years, just getting myself into embarrassing situations, difficult conflicts with my family, and I realized that something had to change. And in my, you know, brilliant mind, I thought that the one solution was I could find myself a psychologist, because as soon as I resolved all my conflicts and all my, you know, deep and profound conflicts and, you know, all these profound feelings that I had, I could be, I could drink like a normal person. So I ended up doing that. I actually went to a psychologist, and to my good fortune, the gentleman was really smart, gentle, and seemed to have been attacked by a CPC committee at some point. But I found myself in good hands, because he did, you know, address some of those concerns that I had in my personal life, but he also really introduced me to someone from Alcoholics Anonymous, who took me to my first meeting back in the Dominican Republic. And I found myself at a meeting of AA without really knowing exactly what I was going to find. I don't think I've ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous before. They talked to me a little bit about it, but the meeting was different. There was this, the magic of AA was there. And people shared their stories, and there were a few things that were important to me. One, that I could identify with the stories they were telling, because they did a lot of the things that I did. They talked about being powerless over alcohol, and I could connect with that. You know, I knew that once I started to drink, I was powerless over it. And the other one was this theory new to me, that this was a disease or an illness. And for me, that was really good news, because all I could think of while I was drinking was that I was crazy and that nobody had really caught on to it. So So I started going to meetings, and little by little, my life started to get better. I stopped drinking, and I felt, you know, like I found something that worked. But again, at this point, and if this was a series, one of those television series, this would be chapter one. Because, of course, you know, I was young-ish. I was probably 26 at the time, but far younger than most of the people in this group that I visited. They were really warm and wonderful, but, you know, I felt I wasn't that bad. Maybe I didn't. They talked about a lot of the other suggestions that we offer. And one of the things was the steps. I felt that that was for the fanatics. No need to get desperate. But you know, as I said, my life started to get better, and I finished school. Was able to immigrate to New York, and for a period of time, when I arrived in New York, I didn't connect with Alcoholics Anonymous. For some, you know, I had it in my mind that I was, I knew what my problem was. I knew I was an alcoholic, and I decided not to drink. And it worked for a little while. A couple of years went by. I was dry as a toast. But I wasn't drinking. Of course, you know, my new circle of friends considered me a very boring person. Which I am, but that's okay. Nevertheless, you know, the moment came when that drink and other outside issues were offered. And I took the drink, and I took the new marvelous solution that was going to fix my drinking. And that, you know, began a whole new process for me, a new bottom. And, you know, it took very little time for me to pick up exactly where I left off. I was, again, the fall-down drunk that slid down the wall, drink in hand, on the floor, but drink in hand. And, you know, things just started to get darker and darker. And I remember this part of my life exactly that way, very dark. Because my drinking escalated very quickly. Now I had other substances that I was inviting into the party. Of course, my whole purpose was to get as drunk as I could, as quickly as I could. And I was not interested in conversation. I started out with a circle of friends that just kept getting smaller and smaller. And at the end, if there was someone there, I didn't want to talk to them. So I found myself again in the same sort of predicament where I knew there was really something wrong that I couldn't fix, and I couldn't get alcohol to work for me. Because at this time, the illusion of the magic, the joy that came with those first drinks were no longer there. For a long time, my drinking was just very hard and just trying to get myself numb without being very successful at it. So I continued this cycle of trying to get wasted on Fridays and through the weekend, and clean myself up on Sundays to try to get to work on Monday, and repent and guilt and shame, and really a rough week. And Thursday I was a little better, and Friday I was rolling again. And I just didn't know why, but I was just kept on rolling. And I realized that, you know, as always, and I found that I've heard it in many shares of people sharing their stories, that, you know, the guilt and the remorse is genuine, and mine was truly genuine, and a big part of it was shame, because I could make a big fool of myself, and I did. And I remember going to work on a Monday morning and actually walking into a group of people that were laughing and telling jokes about something that I had done drunk on Friday or Saturday. And, you know, my whole my spirit just fell flat on the floor because I didn't even have the courage to ask them what I did. What did I do? Because I didn't remember. And, you know, it really shocked me. It really kind of made me pay attention. And at that time, I had a coworker in this job that I had in New York who was getting sober. And I realized that because she would talk about it. And of course, you know, I knew the language. I knew that what she was talking about. And I could see her transformation. I could see her eyes getting brighter. She was smiling. And I think I hated her. But the moment came when, you know, when I was at that darkest point, then I actually decided to ask for help, and I went to her for help. And she asked, you know, she found me, she jumped on it. I mean, like really jumped on it. And she got me a meeting for that night, and I went to my first meeting in New York. And to my good fortune, this was a Spanish-speaking meeting group in New York, and for me that was really a good thing. It was the same, my first language. It was the format that I was more familiar with, and again, I just received the same love and the same warm welcome that I had before, and I identified with the stories, and again, you know, my journey began again. And would you believe that I did the same thing I did the first time? You know, life got better. I stopped drinking. I went to meetings and I got a better job and I got a new apartment. And then the meetings weren't that convenient. I wasn't that, you know, close to them. And so I found myself just drifting out. Slowly but surely just drifting out and finding myself trying to play with the idea that, you know, maybe I could get this right and I could find the right formula. And, you know, and then I started to experiment. And it was not the worst of my drinking or my use of other substances. It just became my darkest point, or what I would consider and hope that it remains my darkest point. Because I felt no hope. I felt completely lost. And, you know, the worst part for me was not that I was afraid of dying. I mean, I was not afraid of dying. I was afraid of living this way for a long time. And I could see myself dragging into the future. And that was not an attractive prospect. And I, you know, felt that complete sense of loss. I did, not that I, you know, didn't kick and scream. I went to a psychiatrist. I did all kinds of things to see if I could find a different solution. But in the end, I knew that I had to come back to AA, and I knew that this was the last house on the block for me. And this was, you know, I had to really find a way. So I called Intergroup in New York, and I found myself going to a meeting that was on the way from, it was actually on the way from the subway to my apartment. And I could see the sign when I walked home from the subway. Of course, I crossed the street. But that's really where Intergroup sent me. So I went down to a church basement, and I found myself sitting in the back of a room. And for a 5 or 10 minutes, I stopped shaking, and I stopped, you know, and I could breathe for 5 minutes. And that was this little sense of hope that came to me. I don't remember anything anybody said, but I do remember that people were smiling. People were laughing, and that, you know, they didn't attack me or anything. But, and, you know, that sense of hope and that little bit of peace that I felt just was enough to for me to continue to come back. And I went back the next day, and I started to get to go to that meeting on a regular basis. And that became my home group. I've always felt that, you know, the message of AA didn't come in through my ears. It came in through my heart, because people spoke with their hearts, and I identified with the feelings and, you know, their suffering and their laughter, you know, and that really was very healing. This time, the big difference in my experience was that I started to take suggestions, which I hadn't done before. I got a sponsor who, to my good fortune, was someone who was gentle, but really would be very clear and very honest. And he spoke about the steps as a solution, as a design for living, as a way of getting myself out of this despair that I felt and this, you know, turmoil that I've dug myself deep into. And little by little, that process really worked. And for me, in my experience, most importantly, I felt I followed whatever this sponsor told me. And he was much more of a doer than a talker. So, you know, I continued to follow him. And at the beginning of this part of the process, I felt that I always, you know, I think they did trick me into making coffee. It was not my plan. And it was the best thing that it could have ever happened to me, because at the beginning I had a resentment that they got me to be carrying this big old pot down, up and down church basement stairs and all of that. But, you know, for a long time, just the thought that I had to make that coffee what kept me going through the days, and I was having a rough time, but I knew I had to get to the group to make the coffee, and that really kept me good through the day, and I made great coffee. I also bought the cookies and decided how they would be laid out. I went through a color period. I did forms, circles, triangles, color coordinated. You picked up a cookie, I came back and fixed the design. Cookie queen. But I loved that part. And that really connected me to AA. I started to feel part of this group. I started to feel little by little part of AA. And, you know, that really just was the beginning. And everything else that was offered, you know, everything that we have in our groups are always, all the suggestions are there to help. And I just had not followed them before. We had an old timer that always used to say, it gets better. And I believed her, you know, and in that sense, you know, I knew I was trusting the process. I was finding a way of, you know, taking what was offered and bringing it into my life. And I'm always grateful for that unconditional love and wide door love of AA that allows me to find my way, find my own higher power, the way that I find it's going to help me. How many meetings I go to. There's nothing mandated, but there are a lot of suggestions. But all the suggestions are good. And you still get unconditional love and a lot of flexibility for you to find your way. And for me, that was really important because, you know, in spite of all the pain that I was in, I really was still always very reluctant if somebody wanted me to, would have said, you know, you have to do this. If it was more of a suggestion, then it was easier for me. And this old-timer, when she said, it gets better, sometimes that it gets even good, she was right. Absolutely right. And, you know, that process of sobriety and getting myself better and feeling a little, you know, stronger and more confident, but above all, a new sense of serenity and peace that I just had not found and that I was always drinking to find that relief, that serenity, that let go of the anxiety. And when, you know, when I didn't have that alcohol, I found that in AA and just kept, it kept me going. So I kept following suggestions. And in my personal experience, one of the suggestions that my sponsor made when I was a few years in was that I apply for a job at the General Service Office. And, you know, I have to confess that it was not my immediate, I'm jumping to this. I just didn't really understand much of that. I didn't certainly didn't feel that I was a perfect AA member. And so I was really very ambivalent about it. And so, but, you know, he was a good sponsor. So he pushed and then instructed. And then I did it. I mean, I sent in an application. And the thing is that, you know, a few months later, to my surprise, I found a letter inviting me to come to an interview. And of course, I didn't even know where I was going. I couldn't believe this letter, that, you know, loving invitation. I mean, who are these people? Who talks this way? But I loved that whole, you know, loving invitation part. And I did. I went to the interview without really being very sure about if that was for me or not. And I found, most importantly, that, you know, everybody that I met, I loved. I wasn't sure about the job, but, you know, person after person that I spoke with were direct, were honest, and they were loving. And I just felt embraced. And, you know, that's one of the people that I spoke to on that day actually said to me that, you know, people come to work here because they think, you know, if you're here in AA, you don't have to go to meetings. Not true. You need to go to more meetings. And she was right. And at the end of that day, I did not know that, you know, if I would be hired or not, but I knew that I would love to work for these people because they just absolutely embraced me, and I felt that kind of love. And I was again very surprised a few weeks later when I received a call from a gentleman that's here, to whom I will be eternally grateful, who said something like, we would love to have you if you want to have us, or something like that. But it was just so different than what I was used to. And, you know, it started 19 years of working at GSO, which has been one of the absolute privileges and pleasures of my life. It has taken me to many places in the world and in the country, both Canada and the U.S. But most importantly, it has offered me and given me the opportunity to meet so many wonderful people, not only inside the office, but outside the office, at the conferences. Everyone that I met through this process of general service has just been a privilege. I have to confess that when I started to work, I didn't know what a DCM was. But you know, that same people really guided me with patience and love and took me by the hand and really taught me everything that I needed to learn to then do the best job that I could possibly do. And it's really continued for all those years until, you know, life moves on and changes and retirement comes, and I am now so gratefully retired that but you know, I knew I had that in my heart and moved on to a new thing. And in my, just to kind of bring it to a more recent time, Once I left the office, a pandemic happened, and then of course we all went into Zoom. And you know, we found this wonderful tool that helps us has helped us stay together and connected. And I liked the fact that I could be connected and stay sober with other alcoholics, even if we had to be secluded or, you know, and we were on Zoom for a while. That was a saving grace. But once Zoom, the pandemic was already coming down, I had to find a new home group. And I started to do that very quickly, because I knew for myself that as wonderful as sobriety was possible with Zoom, I needed that you know, that hug. I needed your smiles. I mean, one thing is, you know, a little box, which is great if you know, if that's what we have, but at the same time, a big hug and a personal smile makes a big difference. So I started to look for a home group, and I did. I found my home group is the Marble Hill group, Marble Hill Kingsbridge group in the Bronx in New York. If you're ever in New York, you can look us up. We meet on Mondays and Wednesdays. And we always love to welcome any visitors. And you know, the first thing I did was get a coffee commitment. Because I knew that if it had worked for me before, and I knew that that's a way for me to connect. And I needed that commitment, and I was very grateful to get it. So I made, again, a lot of coffee and new designs with my cookies. So I truly, truly enjoy that. And now I am, for my sins, the group treasurer. And I am, again, very grateful to for that. So I think I'm drying up, and there's ice cream somewhere in the building. But I do want to say, again, I am, you know, very, very grateful for this opportunity. And I'm very, very grateful for all the kindness and the warm welcomes that I've received. And buenas noches, good night, and thank you for this opportunity.